Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, a conversation about a man many of us grew up with and someone who was and continues to be remarkably influential in the world of early childhood education because of his long-running television show on PBS.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? It's a neighborly day in this beauty wood, a neighborly day for a beauty. Would you be mine? Could you be mine? I have always wanted to have a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live in a neighborhood with you.
Fred Rogers talked to children every day for a good part of his adult life, talking to kids who turned on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for many of its 900-plus episodes because he treated them like friends, like neighbors. He was gentle but honest, compassionate and kind. And he talked to kids like adults, often about some very grown-up, difficult subjects. There's a new film out that captures the spirit of Mr. Rogers. Tom Hanks portrays Fred Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
We are trying to give the world positive ways of dealing with its feelings.
Yeah? Like what?
There are many things you can do. You can play all the lowest keys on a piano at the same time.
And now there's a new book about Mr. Rogers by Charlotte author Gavin Edwards. He's written on a number of pop culture topics, including unconventional biographies of Bill Murray and Tom Hanks. And now he's written one of Fred Rogers, Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. It examines his influence on our culture and on young minds, many now grown up. And Gavin Edwards joins us in our studio. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good morning, Mike.
You're welcome. We're also joined by Maxwell King. He, too, has written about this titan of children's television. Actually, his was the first official biography, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. He's also the former director of the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Children's Media. And he joins us today from the studio in which Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood originated, WQED in Pittsburgh. Thank you for being here this morning.
My pleasure.
Gavin, I'm going to start with you. You recently wrote this biography of Tom Hanks, and you were on the show to talk about this. Tom Hanks just happens to be playing the title role of Mr. Rogers in a movie that's just now out. Does that explain the timing of this book?
It does. I'm attracted to people who have sort of a core of themselves that they sort of, there's a philosophy that they go out and sort of use on the world. And with Bill Murray, it's, you know, sort of he's antic and he wants to wake people up. And with Tom Hanks, there's this like core of decency and like everything he does sort of, you know, springs out of that. But with like, it seemed like there was no purer version than like Fred Rogers, who just had this like deep-seated, you know, sort of like love of children and compassion for children and kindness, and oriented his entire life around that.
You've written a number of biographies, as I just said, and many New York Times bestsellers, and you've written articles that that appeared in Wired and the New York Times and Rolling Stone and more. You watched. I actually thought you were not. That you were too old to have watched Mr. Rogers. So I don't know how old you are, clearly, because I read that you watched Mr. Rogers.
Certainly.
As a child.
Yeah.
So you're just a child to me. Because I was way beyond Mr. Rogers. So what role, if any, did the experience of watching him as a viewer develop in your interest to write this book? Because to write a biography is a lot of work.
So I think for many people, you know, sort of like Mr. Rogers gives you a foundation and then you sort of forget that he was the one who did it. And writing the book and just sort of going back into his neighborhood, like, reopened that for me. Remembering that, you know, sort of like when I was 7 years old and I was sitting on like my family's ugly green couch, I'd, like, day after day drinking it in. And here was this man like looking at me with this and telling me that I was special and really cared about me. And every day we would go to this like magical land of imagination, and I just couldn't get enough. But then you get older and you say, all right, it's not for me. You know, sort of like, you know, he speaks a little slowly, and I'm feeling, you know, sort of like I'm a cool teenager, and you put it beside you. But the things he did like give you a moral foundation, I think, for entire generations.
Wow. Because I read that also when you got to college, you kind of made fun of Mr. Rogers.
Well,
so you've done a full circle.
There was a prank where some friends and I had a candlelight vigil for Mr. Rogers, who was still alive. And, you know, it sort of confused everybody, which was the point. But the thing was, when people gathered for this phony candlelight vigil, everyone ended up being really decent about Mr. Rogers. It was like, oh, right. You know, we just sort of picked somebody arbitrarily because he seems nice, and then, you know, sort of this ends up being a celebration.
And how could you not be, actually? Yeah. Maxwell King is not only the first biographer of Mr. Rogers. He's the former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, but you now live in Pittsburgh, and you spent a considerable amount of time in Pittsburgh running significant organizations in the life of that city, including the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Children's Media. Fred Rogers had passed away by the time you ran that organization, but you had met him years before. What were your impressions of him, Maxwell, off camera?
Well, I only actually met Fred twice. Once was on the street, and we just chatted a little bit. And the other time was in his office here at WQED. And at that time, I was the president of the Heinz Endowments, which is a big charitable foundation here that funded the neighborhood. And so I assumed the reason that the staff invited me over to talk to Fred was to talk about funding, to talk about his program, to talk about his plans, to talk about money. And we spent about an hour and a half in his office, and we talked about our parents. We talked about our kids. We talked about Nantucket, where both of our families have houses. We talked about Pittsburgh. We talked about life. He never said a word about the plans for the program. He never asked a single question about money. And, of course, he got the grant.
Genius.
Yeah. So but that was Fred, you know. Fred was about people and relationships, always.
Was he like the person we saw on television, speaking slowly, very softly, very compassionately? Or was there an edgier side to Mr. Rogers?
No, he was precisely the same, and fun, a lot of fun to talk to. Huh. But there was an edge to him. He was very intense about his work and very intense about accomplishing what he wanted to accomplish. And so he sometimes lost his temper at work, and there could be an edge to him. I think the other thing to note about how similar the real Fred Rogers was to the television Fred Rogers is, to some extent, he had a very difficult childhood. And coming out of that childhood in his teenage years, he sort of pulled himself together and fashioned a persona with which to face the world and do the things that he wanted to do. And that was Mr. Rogers.
You write about Mr. Rogers in an early appearance, both for him and for Oprah, on the pre-syndicated version of the Oprah Winfrey Show. And he was savvy enough to know that if there were children in the audience of the Oprah Winfrey Show, he would start playing to the kids because they were the focus of his life. And so he requested that there be no children, or he had his people request that there be no children in the audience. And when he arrives, of course, Oprah has invited families and their children. And he immediately focuses all of his attention on the kids, not on Oprah. And Oprah kind of loses control of the whole situation. And they responded in that program to what you call his unconditional love, the kids. Was that the pull he had, the kids just feeling that here was a guy, a grown-up, who loved him? Loved them, I should say. I'm sorry.
I think part of it was that Fred was still very focused on his own childhood, and there was a lot about himself and his character that he felt was still childlike. And it's because he had such a difficult childhood, he was shy, he was lonely, he didn't have a lot of friends, that he developed this sort of instinct for understanding and helping children. And his problem was if there were children around, he couldn't help himself. He was going to focus on the children, and that's what happened on that early Oprah show. And it happened another time when he was speaking in Boston, and he came out, one of the people he was with who was speaking at a conference in Boston, he came out to discover an audience that he thought would be all adults had a lot of children in it. And he almost had a panic moment where he felt he just couldn't do it. And it's because it's his instinct to focus on children, but also his standards. He was a guy who set very high standards for himself, and he didn't want to drop the ball.
Wow. We have the battle of biographers here today. Maxwell King, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers, and Gavin Edwards, Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. And Gavin, you quote Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, in a 1983 interview in which he was asked to explain who he was. And he responded, "I'm a composer and a piano player, a writer and a television producer, almost by accident a performer, a husband and a father, and I'm a minister." How does the order of that self-description strike you?
Well, composer comes first, I believe.
Yes.
And that's where his training was. He has a music degree, and you know, he started off. I mean, one of the amazing things about him is he had all of this wide variety of talents, and it was as if he was training for a job that didn't exist yet. That, you know, sort of he spent time, you know, sort of like visiting orphanages and caring for children. He was writing music. He was studying language. Until he came home from college one day and saw television and said, "Oh, I could do this, only I could do it better."
Yeah.
But he had been like accumulating talents without any idea of how to apply them.
Yeah. You start your book about this man with an observation that I think is absolutely true, that way too many people are working overtime to make our world a worse place to live, meaner, louder, dumber, crasser, more selfish. These we are living right now in times that require,
yes,
Mr. Rogers.
Yes.
How would Mr. Rogers, who was very good at explaining difficult things to children, how would he explain what we're witnessing today coming out of D.C.?
I think Mr. Rogers was really good at, among other things, sloughing off what kids didn't need to know. So when something was central to children, like, you know, sort of he would tackle things that perhaps made him uncomfortable, such as divorce. You know, he wasn't ready to, he didn't grow up in a culture that had, like, divorce in it, you know, sort of in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. I don't think he knew anybody whose parents got divorced when he was growing up. But he said, all right, this is really important for children. This is what we need to do. And, you know, when there was other, like, major things in the news, he would, you know, sort of, like, try to give them, like, techniques to, you know, sort of like if you see a crisis, one of his most famous thing is look for the helpers. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of you're always going to find people who are doing things to help people. And so when there's a daily drumbeat of just venom in the air and, you know, sort of like everyone seems to be sort of, it's not that there's one particular news event. It's just that sort of like the whole like world seems to be more toxic. I think he'd fall back on his core values. He'd he'd look children in the eye. He'd sort of like let them know that, you know, sort of no matter what else is going on, you know, sort of like their parents love them. He cares very much about them. He thinks they're special. And if you have that foundation, then you can, you know, sort of be the light in the darkness.
For people who don't know Mr. Rogers very well, perhaps they were too old to watch it, they didn't have kids of TV watching age at that time, I want to give you an example when we come back from the break of how Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, handled a very difficult topic for kids. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Hey all, this is Tommy Tomlinson. On this week's episode of Southbound, we're replaying a conversation from last year with Chef Vivian Howard, former host of A Chef's Life, who has a new show coming to PBS in the spring. You can find this and every episode of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org.
Support for Southbound comes from Southeast Radiation Oncology Group.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about a legend in our business, Fred Rogers. There's a new movie out, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers. And it's a well-deserved presentation because this man continues to be one of the most influential people in early childhood education and also in the business of broadcasting. For all the reasons we're talking about this hour with Maxwell King, the author and former director, the author of The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers, and the former director of the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Childhood Media, Children's Media, and Gavin Edwards, a local author who's written, I don't know how many books. How many books have
12.
You read? 12. You're busy. Including Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. So I wanted to play an example for people who maybe never saw Mr. Rogers or had forgotten how Mr. Rogers handled difficult topics for children. In 1968, following the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, Mr. Rogers did what he did so often. He addressed it directly. He didn't paper it over. He didn't ignore what kids were hearing adults react to. He put it front and center.
What does assassination mean? Have you heard that word a lot today?
Yes. And I didn't know what it meant.
Well, it means somebody getting killed in a sort of surprise way.
That's what happened, you know. That man killed that other man.
I know, and a lot of people are talking about it right now.
Too many people are talking about it.
Maxwell King, he did this time and time again on a series of topics. Was there any pushback to this approach, being so frank with young children?
No, I don't think there was. I think there was great appreciation for the fact that he was willing to jump in at key moments and do something that was helpful not only to children, but helpful to their parents. But I think what that reflects in Fred's work is his seriousness of purpose. That, you know, he started out in the 1950s making a program called The Children's Corner, which was very successful. It won national awards, but he always felt that it was just entertainment. It wasn't educational. And when he got the opportunity to develop Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, he wanted to set the highest, most demanding standards in terms of education. And he, throughout the 1980s, he made these programs called Theme Weeks. One of them, I think Gavin was talking about one of them a moment ago, which was divorce, or you both were talking about that. And so what he would do in the Theme Weeks is he'd devote an entire week to exploring an issue that was important to children, important to everybody, but he was fearless in picking his topics. He did divorce, he did violence, he did death. His programs on death are astonishing, even today and even for grown-ups. So Fred's ability to take all of his creativity and plow it into something that was very, very risk-taking on television, particularly television for children, and demanding that everybody associated with the production meet the highest educational standards was really remarkable.
I think, Gavin, you mentioned this, but both of you write about it in your respective books. Looking for helpers is how he told kids to handle the aftermath or anything that they were curious about. And in the aftermath of 9/11, which was after Fred Rogers' program went off the air,
yes,
PBS brought him back to do a public service announcement produced to help kids understand the 9/11 attacks.
When I was a little boy and something bad happened in the news, my mother would tell me to look for the helpers. You'll always find people helping, she'd say. And I've found that that's true. In fact, it's one of the best things about our wonderful world.
You know, just listening to his voice and his cadence and the calmness and how slowly he spoke, I have to be honest, it sounds odd to adults. it just does. But that, I think, would you agree, Maxwell? And I want to hear both from both of you on this, that this is what allowed children to receive the message.
Tom Juneau, phrased it as, the voice sounds childlike to adults and adult-like to children. And I think that's true, he seems like, he's not, sort of telling them what to do, but he, right. He's speaking the language they can understand. He's not dressed up as a clown. He's not dressed up as a kid, but he's, sort of a comfortable adult. He's wearing a sweater, and that comes through in his presentation visually, and it also comes through in the way he spoke, which naturally was this right. cadence that children were comfortable with.
Maxwell.
And I think it's not just children who found that voice and that slow, deliberate approach comfortable. You know, lots of people here at WQED who worked with him found that also a very comforting part of Fred's presence. One of the producers here was riding the elevator one day and was just furious because he had to go down to the studio and settle a dispute that was going on down there. And he was just boiling mad, and the elevator stopped on a different floor, and Fred got in. And Fred hit the button that stopped the elevator and said, "Dan, I can tell you're upset. Tell me about it." And he did, while they sat there in the elevator. And then Fred said, "Dan, we all know how wonderful you are at your job. You'll handle this just right."
Wow.
So then the producer went on down to the studio, and he did handle it well. And one of the stagehands looked over at him and stuck his thumb up and said, "Pure Fred."
Wow. You write, Gavin, that as a child you thought of Mr. Rogers as someone who kept telling you as a viewer that he liked you just the way you were. And you say you needed to hear that because you were an awkward, lonely child. That's a topic for another show. but let's talk about how Fred became Mr. Rogers and how that approach developed over time. You say he was a sheltered, wealthy kid. Both of you write about this. Sheltered, wealthy kid who was fat when he was growing up, not terribly healthy. And is that where the idea came from for him to understand children who are looking for approval?
I think,
all kids are.
Maxwell knows this story well as well, that, sort of there's one time when, sort of the family chauffeur was supposed to take him home for lunch, which gives you an idea of, sort of the financial echelon the Rogers family was in. And because there was a mix-up, he said, "Oh, I'll just walk home myself." And he was sort of chased home by like a bunch of bullies from the school going, "Fat Freddy, Fat Freddy, we're coming to get you, Fat Freddy." And he had to take shelter in a neighbor's house. And so I think so many people, sort of have childhood traumas and feeling awkward, and everyone feels like they're the only kid in the world who feels awkward.
Well, his parents, the adults in his life at the time, told him to suck it up, essentially, to don't let it bother you. But it did bother him, and he refused to not let it bother him.
And I think most people take his parents' advice. They try to anyway as they get older. You say, "Oh, I'm not going to sort of let those like childhood, I'm going to put that away. I don't want to remember what it felt like to be like an awkward, lonely kid."
Yeah.
But Fred never let it go, and to our benefit.
We talked about, we just said that he was wealthy as a child. Just to give you an idea of this, I think you write, Maxwell, about the fact that when he displayed a talent for piano, his grandmother told him he could get a piano, and he went by himself to a piano store, and he spent the whole day playing all the pianos on the floor of the store, and he decided he wanted the grand piano that you'd see on the stage at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, Steinway Concert Grand.
Okay, and the sales clerk kind of brushed him off because it was the most expensive piano on the floor. It cost $3,000, which is about $70,000 in today's money.
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, what's interesting was that he had a little toy piano, and he played that piano for his grandmother. And when he then asked if he could get a real piano, she committed to him that he could, thinking that a real piano would be some very modest instrument for a kid who was only about 10 years old. But he took it seriously, and he went downtown and he played all those pianos, as you said, picked out the Steinway Concert Grand, went home and told his grandmother and told her how much it cost. And to her extraordinary credit, she said to herself, "I made the commitment, I have to keep the commitment. And she also said to herself, he's worth it. His talent is worth it. And she bought him this Steinway Concert Grand, as you say, worth $70,000 in today's dollars. And he had it for the rest of his life. He took it with him to New York. He took it with him to Toronto. He brought it back to Pittsburgh. He had it here at the studio at WQED. He then had it in his apartment. He wrote 200 songs on it. He wrote 13 operas on it. He played it in so many of the shows. And so that gesture, more than a gesture, I guess, that great gift from his grandmother was really life-changing for Fred. And it positioned him to take his first love, music, and integrate it. And this is something Gavin was referring to earlier, integrate it with all these other great talents that he had and fashion a career where he could use all of his talents, which is really amazing.
And turns out to be one of the best investments anybody's ever made in anybody's life.
Absolutely. Yeah. Which tells you something.
Yeah. But explain to me how a kid who grew up in such a privileged environment where his grandmother could afford to do that for him and where he had a chauffeur and a cook, etc., decided to live his adult life, in which he was extremely successful, very modestly. He drove an old beat-up car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He didn't live in a big house. He had
an unheated
cabin, vacation cabin. What's that all about?
I think, you know, sort of the things that were important to him, he had. You know, he never actually wanted for anything, but he wasn't acquisitive. And what he really cared about was the ability to do the show. So the points in his life where he really had to, like, go around saying, I can't afford this, is when he was early on, when he's trying to get Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood up on the air. Like, hey, I've got this idea for a show, and I've got, like, footage from Canada. You know, so he has to first, you know, sort of go to a local department store and say, you know, sort of like, can we do a series that you'll sponsor on weekends? And, you know, and he's trying to drum up money and sponsorship. And I think that's the only time in his life that he's really wanted for something financially.
Let's talk about how this began for him. For a guy who became unequivocally the most important person in children's television and continues to have a legacy in that area, there have been TV shows for kids since the beginning of television. I grew up watching Ding Dong School with Miss Frances and Romper Room with Miss Nancy, and then there was Sesame Street. But Fred Rogers was completely different. His approach was completely different. And I think one of you argues, I think it was you, Maxwell, that when he first saw a television, it was in his family's music room. He'd never seen one before. He did not watch Your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar. He did not watch Jackie Gleason. He wanted to know what was on in the afternoon for children. And so he turned it on and he watched it, and he was appalled by what he saw.
Well, I think two things happened, Mike. He was appalled by the content of the television that he saw, that it was very slapstick, you know, people throwing pies in each other's faces and stuff like that. But another thing happened, which was he immediately and instinctively saw the educational potential of television. And back then, this is the late 1940s, people were not seeing that potential in television. That television was conceived of primarily as a commercial vehicle. It was a place to sell cereal and other things like that. And Fred Rogers immediately understood that this was an instrument that could have tremendous educational potential and that he could use. And he went to his parents. His parents were wonderfully tolerant because he kept changing. You know, every few days he changed the idea of what he was going to do. He had told his mother he was going to go to the seminary, which eventually he did. His father was still hoping he'd come into the family business. And he went out and told them, no, I want to go to New York and go into television.
You know,
And then he did, because he got some help from his father, who was connected with RCA.
We all take television today for granted. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's been part of our lives since the day we were born. This is, to him, television is like the internet or social media is to kids today, who saw something in it that adults probably didn't see. And he had they were making it up. No one knew what television was.
Yes.
And as you said just a second ago, his father had a connection at RCA. RCA at the time owned NBC. He got his kid a job in television on the floor crew, moving cameras around and props and sets. And at one point, Mr. Rogers was in charge of color television at NBC. There were three. They had a studio set up for color TV as an experiment. There were three television sets in the world that this went to. The CEO of RCA, the CEO of NBC, and somebody else at NBC. And his job was to put colored objects in front of the color cameras so they could see whether or not this was something that people would want to invest money in and buy.
And, of course, he was red-green... colorblind.
He was colorblind.
So they'd say, like, move the green chair. He's like, which one's the green chair?
But he learned one of the really most important lessons of television, which is just plow ahead, fake it, and get it done. So he asked people around him enough questions to be able to do what was required.
So he was making this up. They were all making this up. People have to understand that nobody knew anything about how to do television because it had never been done. They didn't know what they were doing. They just made it up. And so he was part of that process. Somehow he found his way to Canada and the Canadian Broadcasting Company, and he started doing children's programming there, first as a producer, and then somebody said, no, you need to be in front of the camera. How did that happen?
Well, he was actually invited up to be a host. He had been behind the scenes in Pittsburgh on his show Children's Corner, where he's doing some of the puppets through the wall with the host, Josie Carey, on camera. And he's playing piano and he's writing songs with her. But the CBC saw him and said, I see how you relate to children. You know, sort of like you can do that on camera. And he was very reluctant at first. You know, sort of he had had only the most fleeting appearances on camera. He had weirdly come out like with a domino mask on to like teach kids about ballroom dancing. But he like even then he's got a mask. He's hiding. He's not sure he wants to be there. So he really had no intention of becoming a television personality. He thought he was going to achieve his mission behind the scenes.
Was that persona that we know today as Mr. Rogers there from the beginning?
Yes. Yeah, I think that, you know, sort of like by the time you can see the earlier versions of it and it molds, but because it was out of him, it was always there. He was putting his own like best forth version self.
And I think perhaps the word persona is not an accurate word to use in his case. And we'll talk about that and several other things about Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers, when we come back with Maxwell King and Gavin Edwards on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and today we're talking about Mr. Rogers, a man who deserves to be talked at length about and evidently written at length about, because we have two biographers on the program. One's a brand new biography that just came out, Gavin Edwards, his local author, Kindness and, well, although he's been published in every publication known to man, and he has New York Times bestsellers more than you can count, author of Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. He's in our studio. Maxwell King is the former director of the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Children's Media and the author of the very first biography of Mr. Rogers, The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers. And he joins us this morning from the studios of WQED in Pittsburgh, which is where Mr. Rogers was produced. Another example of Mr. Rogers. In 1969, when black Americans were still prevented from swimming in public pools alongside white people, Mr. Rogers invites Officer Clemens, one of the characters on his show, a black police officer, to cool his feet alongside him in a small plastic wading pool on his TV show.
Oh, there's Officer Clemens. Hi, Officer Clemens. Come in.
Rogers, how are you?
Fine. Won't you sit down?
Oh, sure. Just for a moment.
It's so warm. I was just putting some water on my feet.
Oh, it sure is.
Would you like to join me?
It looks awfully enjoyable, but I don't have a towel or anything.
Oh, you share mine.
Okay,
sure.
Yeah. Fred Rogers very subtly explaining racism and how to overcome it in children at a time when it was a controversial topic. He handled that with as though he was talking about tissue paper.
At a time when swimming pools in the South were often segregated.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of like in the violent protests back and forth over that. And he makes it seem he doesn't have to say this is the context of it for children. He just sort of presents this very strong visual image of this is my friend. Here's like our ankles in the pool next to each other, and it's, you know, we're toweling each other off, and it's the most normal thing in the world.
That's a very liberal thing to do mm-hmm. in 1969, and he was on public television, and PBS has long been the slap around child of members of Congress who don't like the liberal media, and PBS has often been called on the carpet for their liberal programming, and that's not what they do, but that's what they're accused of doing. So just 1 year after he started the show, he'd been on the air doing it in regional public broadcasting circles, but just a year after he started doing Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on PBS nationwide, he testified before Congress on behalf of public television about the value of his program and his approach to children, and he was asked to be the focal point of this. There were other people at PBS, but they said, no, Mr. Rogers needs to be the point man.
I give an expression of care every day to each child to help him realize that he is unique. I end the program by saying, you've made this day a special day by just your being you. There's no person in the whole world like you, and I like you just the way you are. And I feel that if we in public television can only make it clear that feelings are mentionable and manageable, we will have done a great service for mental health. I think that it's much more dramatic that two men could be working out their feelings of anger, much more dramatic than showing something of gunfire. I'm constantly concerned about what our children are seeing. And for 15 years, I have tried in this country and Canada to present what I feel is a meaningful expression of care.
He certainly did that. Did the message get through? When you look at what we have on TV today and the problems we have in society today and the fact that most video games are violent in their nature and kids play video games today like they used to watch television, Maxwell, was anybody listening or was he spitting into the wind?
I think for years Fred was very frustrated by television. You know, after that testimony at the hearing, Fred became sort of the spokesperson for many decades for high-quality television, not just educational television, but for the idea that television could not only be educational but could be culturally uplifting. And he became the spokesperson that enunciated that view. And he was very frustrated throughout a lot of his career. His wife, Joanne, told me that there were times that he literally got depressed about the directions that television was going in, and said to her, maybe I've wasted my life. But he always came out of that, talking to her, talking to his friends, praying, as he often did. He came out of that to a more optimistic view. And, of course, in the last few years of his life with cable television, he saw the beginning of an explosion of much more high-quality programming. Mm. Also, the other thing that happened was many, many of the producers of children's television began to pick up on the example that Fred set and began to use approaches that were guided by the values that Fred Rogers had and guided by the much more slow-paced sort of a approach. So I think by the end of his life, I think he was encouraged by the directions that television was taking, both children's television and adult television.
There have been, Gavin, a lot of important children's TV shows on the air over the years, some of which I've already mentioned. There was Captain Kangaroo, who reigned supreme in the morning, Monday through Friday, on CBS, which accounts for why CBS's morning show is still last in the ratings. They were late into the game because Captain Kangaroo had that time slot. And there was also, of course, PBS's Sesame Street, which was as influential, perhaps in many different ways, as Mr. Rogers. But talk about the impact he had versus those other shows.
Well, he recognized those shows specifically as his peers, he had a great appreciation for Captain Kangaroo, and he got on the phone every year on New Year's Day with Bob Keeshan. Would call him up and they would catch up on their, and he said, he's a great advocate for children, which was pretty much the highest praise Fred could pay to anybody. With Sesame Street, it was... there was a more of a subtly competitive vibe. In fact, when Big Bird was a guest on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the subject of the show that week was competition.
and, the kids understand that?
Someone pressed Fred on this, and he's like, at first he's like, no, that was an accident. And they said, well, maybe it was unconscious.
You call his program the most powerful, beneficial programming ever created for very young children. And you say he was a technological innovator and entrepreneur decades before such work was popularly recognized. He was a restless crusader for higher standards in broadcasting. And you say he was a driven man. Let's parse that. In what way was he a technological innovator and entrepreneur?
Well, I think his use of storytelling and his use of music, puppeteering, and his use of going from two very different elements in one program, from the neighborhood where his house was to the neighborhood of make-believe, were all extremely innovative. Of course, Sesame Street was also extremely innovative, but there was some controversy, between Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. So enough controversy, actually, that a couple of scholars at Yale University studied the two programs side by side and tried to analyze what made each one successful or not successful. And early on, they concluded, remember, when Sesame Street started, it was very fast-paced, and it used a lot of the techniques that are used in television advertising, quick cuts, fast-paced, that sort of a thing. And Rogers, of course, was the opposite. Very, very slow, sticking with one theme. And these two academics, a married couple named Singer, studied them both and discovered that for very young children, this is for children who are 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years old, they retained much more of what they learned from Fred Rogers, who, was focusing on social and emotional learning more than numbers and letters. And what's interesting is, if you look at Sesame Street's programming over the years, they adjusted. They slowed down. They began to focus more on social and emotional learning and to do it at a slower pace. So it was a very interesting kind of competition between the two.
I said you described him as driven. And when you look at Mr. Rogers on TV, he is the most laid-back person I've ever seen. In what way was he driven, and how did that manifest itself?
Well, he was driven to set high standards, and he was driven to accomplish things.
Okay.
And his staff would often the staff loved him, and they loved working with him and felt as if he treated them quite well and gave them lots of opportunities to excel. But Fred always had a vision of what he wanted to accomplish, and he was relentless and stubborn in making sure that his vision got accomplished. There were times he had a great mentor at the University of Pittsburgh Child Education Department named Dr. Margaret McFarlane, and there were times when Fred would have a whole crew filming an episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood here at WQED and stop everything because there was a phrase or a word that he thought was wrong, that wasn't going to be the right thing for children. And a few times he stopped everything, left the crew cooling their heels, and went over to Pitt to talk to Dr. McFarlane to make sure that it was perfect. And perfect was really what he was after.
Wow. Both of you have described in your books the role religion played in Mr. Rogers' life. He was a minister. Would you say that his approach, his moral center, the way he talked to children about right and wrong, is kind of the purest manifestation of Christianity or the Golden Rule or something that came from many world religions?
I think it absolutely was, you know, I mean, he was a very religious man. He would wake up at 5 a.m. every morning, like, so that he could have time and, like, sort of, like, the meditation and prayer and, you know, reading the Bible. He was very careful to not make sure that it didn't exclude people of different faiths, that, you know, he didn't want it to be sort of, like, explicitly one creed or another. But, you know, sort of, like, he was really trying to distill, you know, sort of like the best lessons of like Jesus Christ in the Bible mm-hmm. into sort of like the values that he could communicate with children. So he, you know, sort of never had a formal congregation when he got ordained, but he, you know, sort of like got special permission, like, all right, my ministry is on television and my congregants are sort of all the children who are watching.
Yeah. When we talk about this guy now, because he's no longer with us, and it's nice to speak nice of those who have passed on, but both of you say he wasn't a saint, and it's a trap you can easily fall into with Mr. Rogers because of he's Mr. Rogers,
right?
But he wasn't a saint, and in fact he one of you says he could be tone deaf when talking to adults, and he saw a psychiatrist.
Well,
for years. Nothing wrong with seeing a psychiatrist, but why Mr. Rogers?
I think it's because he was driven. And I think that the fact that he was so driven by his principles, his values that Gavin just described, put a lot of pressure on him. And I think he felt that pressure. He was not a saint. He would be horrified if anybody called him a saint. Although he was one of the most extraordinarily good people that ever lived, but I think he felt a lot of pressure from himself to meet the standards that he set for himself and for the world.
Gavin, when you were a senior editor staff writer at Details magazine,
yes.
you were pitched an interview
yes.
with Fred Rogers by one of his people. And
David Newell, who was also Mr. McFeely on the show.
Okay, and what you wanted to do with that interview did not exactly fit with, what, with the image that they wanted to project, and so they turned you down.
Yes.
And
oh,
took...
Gavin, you're the writer that David Newell told me about.
So that led to them taking this to Esquire, where they wrote an article that has become the basis now for the Tom Hanks film. Boy, did you screw up. And Maxwell, when you became a director of the Fred Rogers Center, you encouraged the family to commission a biography of his life. The writer of that Esquire article, Tom Janot, had wanted to turn his article into a biography. He was adamantly opposed to this. He did not want the spotlight on him. So, Maxwell, you wrote the first biography. Gavin, you've written the next one, which is now out. From what you know of Fred Rogers, how would he feel about both of your efforts, Gavin?
Well, I think he would always want to turn the attention back to, like, the fundamental mission of, you know, sort of, like, is this good for children? Is it helping people? He was not... Like later in his life, you know, sort of, he would actually go out and, you know, sort of like speak at college graduations and would remind adults of like the lessons that he had taught them when they were young. So I hope that he would be okay with all these other books written by people if it sort of like relit what people had in them when they originally watched his show.
So I have 30 seconds left here, and Fred Rogers is among the most influential and consequential people ever to appear on television. Did he leave behind an example, a lasting legacy, that people will continue to borrow from and use as a basis?
Yes, because look at what happens today. People keep coming back to him. kids who grew up with him and are now adults, adults who were parents and watched the program, they come back again and again and again for his lessons when times are stressful.
Maxwell King is the author of The Good Neighbor, The Life and Work of Fred Rogers, and the former director of the Fred Rogers Center for Early Learning and Children's Media. Gavin Edwards has the newest book on Fred Rogers, Kindness and Wonder, Why Mr. Rogers Matters Now More Than Ever. Thanks for the hour.
Please won't you be my neighbor?
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.